Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Cybersecurity rears its ugly head again. There's a bad new virus out there. Get through college in 3 years, save tens of thousands of dollars. There's a plan for that. And hey, what's up, Europe? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 29th of May. Glad to have you with us. So you know how the IT people at work are always giving you a hard time about network security, about passwords and not using files you're not sure of and all that? Yeah, you ought to listen to them. We learned today of a brand new virus that could conceivably do very bad things. It's called Flame. It's been found so far mostly in the Middle East, and it's bringing back memories of a virus from a couple of years ago called Stuxnet that got cyber warfare experts very, very nervous. Liam Omerko is an analyst at Symantec. He does viruses like these things for a living. Liam, welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Thank you very much.
What is this thing, Flame?
Flame is an information-stealing threat that we have recently discovered, and it's interesting because it has been found in Middle Eastern countries exclusively. We haven't seen it anywhere except in the Middle East, and it's capable of stealing all sorts of information, keystrokes. It's able to take screenshots of your computer. It's able to listen in on your microphone, and it's able to discover Bluetooth devices that are nearby.
You mentioned that it's an intelligence-gathering tool. Could it do physical damage? I mean, could it get into an electrical grid? Could it get into some kind of corporate network?
Well, the way Flame is written is that it's very modular. So the attackers can add in new modules at any time, and they can update it very easily. So the attackers could choose to do that in the future. But from what we see right now, it's exclusively being used for information stealing and to spread to other computers. So it's able to infect other computers on your network, and it's able to spread to them, and it's able to collect information from all of those computers.
Is it like Stuxnet in that it's designed to do physical damage to equipment, famously the centrifuges over in Iran?
No. So Flame is not able to change how physical machinery works in the way that Stuxnet did. It is strictly for stealing information. And the reason that it's similar to Stuxnet is that it appears to be a politically motivated threat, a covert threat that is operating in Middle Eastern countries, which is very similar to where Stuxnet operated. But the threats themselves are different. They have different capabilities, and they're written by different people.
There's probably a short list of countries that would get behind this. Care to hazard any guesses?
Well, we don't know, actually, but it's interesting to see that we found this threat, or at least the threat has been reported in Iran, Lebanon, and Palestinian West Bank. So that, as you're saying, that does narrow down who is likely to be behind it.
Do I have to worry about this thing on my laptop at home?
Probably not so much, particularly now, because seeing as how this is a very targeted attack, unless you are, you know, living in the Middle East and are engaged in something that the attackers are interested in, you probably don't need to worry about this threat.
Is the building and deploying of one of these things a billion-dollar proposition, million-dollar proposition? I mean, how expensive is it?
It's expensive, but you're not talking billions of dollars, no. Millions, maybe, would be more accurate. In this particular threat, it looks like it was written by people who normally write legitimate software. So this threat, for example, it carries a database inside it, and it interacts with the database for storing information and for accumulating information. Whereas normally with malware, we see them just using plain files, plain text files, things like that.
Last question for you, Mr. Omerko. Who gets to decide that this thing is called Flame?
Well, normally the researchers decide that. And in this particular case, researchers looked at the code inside the threat. And then the word flame is used extensively within the threat. So the researchers picked that out and decided to call it Flame. We normally try to call it something that we can uniquely identify in files. If we see a new version, we would see that name and we would know, oh yes, this is Flame again.
Right. Liam Omerku, he's an analyst at Symantec, the virus people. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
No viruses to speak of on Wall Street today. The major indices started the week on a high note. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a bankruptcy filing in New York last night that's worth a mention. The law firm of Dewey and LaBeouf is going out of business. It had as clients in better days some of the biggest of American companies, AT&T, Disney, and eBay among them. It is now among the biggest American law firms to fail. And the way that Dewey LaBeouf went under could be a legal cautionary tale, as our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore explains.
Not that long ago, Dewey and LaBeouf had 1,300 lawyers and a stellar reputation for advising companies on bankruptcy. Now it needs some of that $1,000-an-hour advice. Dewey's collapse has more than a passing resemblance to a certain bank failure.
It's very much akin to Lehman Brothers in terms of making wrong bets at the wrong time.
That's William Henderson, a law professor at Indiana University. Like Lehman, Dewey took big financial risks, not buying mortgages, but acquiring people. It lured superstar lawyers by the dozen and guaranteed them millions of dollars in pay, no matter how the economy fared or whether they brought in clients. It does sound like a Wall Street bank, doesn't it?
The root of the legal profession's troubles these days is the fact that they do so much work with investment banks and want to become like them, at least in terms of remuneration.
Henderson says this system of hired guns has weakened the culture of law firms. Before the financial crisis, lots of law firms acted like Wall Street banks, competing on sky-high pay packages. As business dried up, they turned on their own, covering the newcomers' pay by demoting existing partners.
So rather than solve the problem, they just took out pens and paper and decided who got to be thrown overboard.
That's Edwin Reeser, who advises law firms on management. Dewey borrowed millions of dollars to support its pay packages. Its distress was palpable by January. One Dewey lawyer says so many people were scrambling to find jobs over the past 2 months that no one paid attention to the emptying offices.
Even when you're selling your time at $750 or $1,000 an hour, you can still go bankrupt if people lose faith in the enterprise.
Nearly two-thirds of Dewey's 300 partners already work at other law firms, some of which are struggling with their own finances. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Over the weekend, more than 100 people, including dozens of children, were killed in the Syrian town of Hula, as I'm sure you've heard. Witnesses blame militias backed by the government of President Bashar al-Assad. The response today was what could be called diplomatic hardball. Several countries, including the U.S. and Britain, have given Syrian diplomats 7 days to get out. But diplomacy aside, Syrian sanctions have already been tried without measurable results, as Marketplace's David Gura reports from Washington.
Syria has faced U.S. sanctions for a long time now, since the 1990s. So when this latest uprising began with the Arab Spring,
it really had little additional leverage that it could bring to bear against the Syrian government through additional sanctions.
Brian Early teaches political science at the University of Albany, and he says the U.S. and the European Union have relied on what are called smart sanctions.
Those are efforts to use economic sanctions more as scalpels instead of sledgehammers.
Targeting individuals, cutting off their access to assets. We've also seen some new broader sanctions. Last year, the EU banned Syrian oil imports. Joshua Landis directs the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma.
The sanctions have been devastating for the Syrian economy.
It's gotten harder to get wheat, and Landis says cooking gas has gotten expensive.
The point of this is to try to starve the country while you feed the opposition.
With money and with weapons. So far, Syria has been sanctioned by the U.S. and by the EU and the Arab League, but not by the United Nations. And Brian Early doesn't expect that'll change.
The joint reservations of both Russia and China concerning sanctions make it unlikely that there will be any robust international sanctioning effort coming out of the United Nations Security Council anytime soon.
Both those countries have been trading partners with Syria, and the Assad regime has relied on Russia in particular for weapons. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
All right, so we've got a theory around here that goes a little something like this. Man, all those European debt crisis stories, they sure do start to sound the same after a while. So today and for the foreseeable future, something different.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
In which we make the rounds over there to figure out what the actual news is, what really matters to people. First, today to Spain, where there's new talk of a multi-billion dollar banking bailout that the government can't quite figure out how to pay for. We got journalist Miguel Ancho Morado on the phone this morning from Madrid, and he and I got to talking about what matters more to Spaniards right now, bond yields or who's winning in the La Liga soccer standings.
Well, both things are important. I think for the first time, bond yields are almost as important. Even if people didn't know much about it until recently, they didn't know the meaning of these arcane terms, but now they are becoming commonplace part of our everyday life.
Well, what's more in the headlines over there? Is it Spanish problems or Greek problems?
Well, actually, the irony is that Spain's crisis have very little to do with that of Greece. But we are, of course, very conscious that if something goes wrong with Greece, people will immediately look to Spain to see what happens here and whether we are next. This doesn't make a lot of sense in economic terms, but in psychological terms it does. And we know that, and we know that everything that happens in Greece immediately affects Spain's bond yields and borrowing costs.
Yeah, tell me about that psychological effect. I mean, what are people walking around talking about this all the time?
Well, they do, of course. And this is quite new for a country like Spain, in which the economy has never been very important. Even culturally, talking about money in Spain has always been frowned upon. So having to talk about the economy is something new, but it now has become, as I said, commonplace. Well, they say that economic crisis is God's way to teach us economics. So it seems that we are learning the hard way.
I hadn't heard that one before. Miguel Morado in Madrid. Miguel, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
There was an item in the Washington Post last week that piqued our interest. The president of an elite private college in Connecticut said he's looking for ways to make school cheaper and let students graduate in less time. The school is Wesleyan University. The president, Michael Roth, is also an alum at Wesleyan. And back in the day, he got through in 3 years to save his parents some money. And with tuition where it is now, two fewer semesters can mean even bigger savings. Michael Roth, it's good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
How is this going to work? Do you just double up on courses and work in the summertime?
No, we don't actually have to double up on courses at all. If a student enters with two AP credits and does some work in the summertime, students won't have to take an overload at all during their 3 years at Wesleyan.
But they'll have to do a little bit extra, right?
Well, the summer work is extra, and not everybody has APs upon coming in. But if they do the intensive summer sessions and have some AP credit, they could actually just take the, in our case, four courses a semester. Many of our students already take five courses a semester from time to time, and they'd be free to do that, too.
One of the other things in this post that struck us was that you are going to link tuition increases to inflation and not the somewhat greater than inflation increases that higher education seems to have become used to.
Yes.
How are you going to do that? You're going to dip into the endowment? It's stuff is expensive.
Yes, it is expensive. But I think that we have a problem in higher education. So at Wesleyan, a lot of students are on financial aid, and we can't keep raising tuition for those folks. So I've said to the board that we should raise tuition not as high as we can because so many people want to get in, but as much as we have to in order to keep pace with inflation. And in order to do that, we'll have to cut costs, and we have done that in the last few years without affecting the academic core of the institution.
One of the other things you said down in the fifth, sixth paragraph or so is that in the last year or so, you have come to realize that the current business model of higher education, of ever-increasing tuition and higher fees, is unsustainable. And with all respect, I have to ask, only in the last year, where you been?
Well, it's a good question, and a lot of people have said that over the last many years that the increases are out of control. At Wesleyan, we have 10,000 applications for a class of 745 students, and many of those applicants are demanding the amenities that families have come to expect in higher ed. What we've said is we're going to start trimming away the inessential parts of our operation to focus on those things that prepare students most for what comes after the university. In my view, it would be great for Wesleyan to educate more students over more years. We'll replace the students who graduate early with other students. And if we can educate more people in a more economical fashion, well, I think we're doing our job.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Time, 1787, place, Philadelphia.
They were drinking beer for breakfast, unair-conditioned. They were miserable. A couple of them occasionally would show up drunk and give a six-hour speech. True story.
Rewriting the Constitution, but first, let's do the numbers. Signs or maybe hopes that political turmoil in Greece might be easing helped reassure Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials bounced 125 points higher. That's 1%, 12,580. The NASDAQ added 33 points, almost 1.2%, closed at 2870. The S&P 500 advanced 14 points, 1.1%, wrapped up at 1332. Stock in Bank of America beefed up more than 4% today thanks to some hopeful housing market news. Morgan Stanley shares banked a gain of nearly 3%. A lot of investors were still slapping their foreheads over Facebook today. For the first time, the stock slid below not 30, yes, but $29 a share from its initial $38 asking price. Shares of Facebook lost nearly 10% today. There was also news that Facebook could be looking to snatch up Opera, one of the last major web browsers available for a takeover. Shares of Norway's Opera software jumped as much as 25% on that news. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors releases data on pending home sales for April. In Washington, President Obama reauthorizes the Export-Import Bank, an agency that lends millions of dollars to American businesses. And in San Francisco, it's the Rock, Paper, Scissors Pub Crawl. Grab a drink and get your fix of some old-fashioned schoolyard competition. I'm Gina Delvac.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You've heard about the radioactive fish, right? Bluefin tuna that have been found off the coast of California carrying radiation from the Fukushima meltdown in Japan all the way across the Pacific Ocean. That's about as far as a quick glance at the headlines will get you, but it turns out there's not all that much to really get worked up about. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains why.
The news doesn't affect you tuna sandwich eaters.
This is high-end sushi tuna.
Gavin Gibbons is a spokesman for the National Fisheries Institute.
Americans eat about the weight of a few paperclips worth of bluefin every year per capita.
It also doesn't mean anything to those of you who crave spicy tuna rolls.
Nobody would waste their bluefin on that.
Logan Koch is the VP of Purchasing for Santa Monica Seafood.
Bluefin tuna typically on the Japanese auctions are some of the most expensive fish ever.
And even for you listeners, and this is public radio, so I know you're out there, even for those of you who love your pricey sushi, the news shouldn't put you off. The level of radiation the researchers found in the bluefin tuna is below safe levels established by the U.S. government. But
we would be advising people to avoid bluefin tuna anyway.
Dr. Tom Pickerel is a researcher at Monterey Bay Aquarium's Seafood Watch. He suggests people avoid the fish because there just aren't that many of them left swimming around, and catching them often involves killing other sea critters. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
We are, as of today, about three-quarters of the way through the working life of the 112th Congress. Thing is, there hasn't been all that much actual working going on in Washington. If you measure the legislative branch by the amount of legislating it's done, 119 bills have been passed and sent to the president so far. That is less than half the recent average. And with the president and most members of Congress already in campaign mode, well, Marketplace's John Dimsdale has the story.
Washington's pundits make it sound like a whole lot of cans have been kicked down the road past Election Day. The list of things not getting done ranges from health care and tax reform to student loan interest rates and reducing the deficit. Looming at the end of the year are the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and the Obama payroll tax breaks. The alternative minimum tax kicks in with a vengeance. And then there's $1 trillion worth of across-the-board spending cuts as a result of the failure of the supercommittee. Resolving all of this promises to be one bumpy ride, according to former Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson. He's been at the center of efforts to deal with the nation's debts as co-chairman of the Simpson-Bowles Commission.
From Election Day, November 6th to December 31st, you want to keep your microphone hot. It's going to be chaos in America because there's going to be $5 to $7 trillion worth of stuff floating around in there. And at that point, they will come up with something before December 31st that won't be perfect, but it will be done.
But in the meantime, nothing gets done.
Not between now and November 6th, because you will get your little tootsies burned awful bad by your constituents.
Simpson says politicians are too afraid of voter backlash to cut government benefits or raise taxes to pay for them. Meanwhile, the federal flood insurance program is about to expire. There are nearly 80 empty federal judgeships, and the nation's surface transportation program is on its 9th short-term extension. Michigan's transportation director, Kurt Seidel, says congressional dithering is forcing states to hold up infrastructure repairs.
Some of them have some major projects that they've said, look, that project, you know, a big bridge project, big road project, is not going forward until this thing is solved, because that's the money that they've got allocated towards it.
How bad is Washington's partisan gridlock? Veteran congressional observer Norman Ornstein has co-authored a new book called It's Even Worse Than It Looks.
And I think the biggest poster child for the dysfunction that we have in our government is the debt bomb. This is something, if we don't deal with it in the next 5 years or so, could lead to catastrophe.
Ornstein thinks disgruntled moderate voters are staying home, leaving Washington polarized by passionate partisans. He suggests requiring citizens to show up at the polls, like in Australia, or at least enticing them with a lottery that awards one lucky voter a $1 million prize. The odds of that passing are probably similar to those of winning the lottery. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There are plus or minus 4,500 words in the U.S. Constitution. Not all that lengthy a document. But still, how many of us have actually read the thing? Kevin Blyer has, and he's got some edits he'd like to suggest. Blyer writes for The Daily Show, and his new book about the Constitution is called Me, the People. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Oh, my pleasure. Happy to be here.
All right. Why, man? Why write this book? Isn't the Constitution good enough?
It's a perfectly fair question, but I don't have to tell you and your listeners, of course, that Thomas Jefferson himself prescribed that I rewrite the Constitution. In that, he actually suggested that every Constitution naturally expires after 19 years. So by his math, this should have been rewritten 11 times by now. So actually, I feel bad that I'm just getting to it. I've been slacking for over 200 years.
It struck me as I was flipping through this thing, and especially that bit about you in the rotunda of the National Archives waiting to see this document. This thing's now a tourist attraction, right? I mean, nobody reads it. Nobody can tell you how many sections there are, all of that stuff.
That's precisely right. I, in fact, did in my vast research for this book, or I might like to call it, I guess, my me-search. I did, in fact, go read the Constitution. Now, anyone can say they've read the Constitution, although one in four actually remember having ever done so. And for that matter, even our representatives. John Boehner famously said that his favorite part of the Constitution was, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
That's so funny. That's not in the Constitution.
Exactly. It's in the Declaration of Independence. And again, I cast no aspersions. I am no better than this. I'm certain that had you asked me before I started this project, how does the Constitution begin, I would have said, it's the best of constitutions, it was the worst of constitutions.
I went and got myself a more modern version of the Constitution before I came in here. I did the whole HTML thing on the web, and I did a little search. And if you do that with the Constitution, on the words taxes and commerce, you get three mentions of taxes and two mentions of commerce. And yet here we have the foundation for the American economy.
There are a lot of things that the Constitution does not mention by name. Slavery, democracy, Facebook. Can you imagine that? They forgot to mention Facebook, and that seems pivotal to
our existence
these
days. They ought to put that in there, man. Come on.
I was about to say, considering how it's doing, perhaps they were wise to overlook it.
Yes.
But you're right. Taxes, they don't actually address it too much. Alexander Hamilton, of course, tried to step in after the Constitution was written and did his best to make sure, as you know, we have a national bank and what have you. And I don't propose in my new constitution that we go back to bartering chickens. So you don't need to worry about
that. Well, that's the thing. This is as much a history book that you've written as it is a rewriting of the Constitution.
I was just so thoroughly amused, specifically about the goings-on at the Constitutional Convention, that I couldn't help but make it a history book. Because people do not know just how rollicking those 4 months were in 1787. They were so sick of each other by the end of that summer that they just wanted to get something written. They weren't even that thrilled with it. Washington and Franklin famously said, I wish it were more perfect.
As you point out, what do you expect from a bunch of guys who had beer for breakfast?
They were drinking beer for breakfast, unair-conditioned, powdered wigs, remember. There was rioting going on outside, and it was the summer. Speaking of bad weather, they were miserable. A couple of them occasionally would show up drunk and give a six-hour speech. True story.
Oh,
but they also have the understanding that we are just efforting at getting better at this.
Kevin Blyer, his book is called Me, the People. It's about the Constitution. Give it a read. Kevin, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, the sustainably minded among you who also like to drive really, really fast can take heart from Ferrari today. Business Week reports the Italian supercar maker is coming out with a hybrid. Two electric motors running alongside, get this, a 12-cylinder gas engine. Price tag, more than $850,000. Dollars, which raises two questions in my mind anyway. One, do people who can pay $850,000 for a car really care how much they're paying for gas? And also, does one of you have a spreadsheet that you can help me out with and figure out the payback period for this thing? How long would it take to save enough on gas to make up for the sticker price? Letters, marketplace.org. That's where you can send it. In the meanwhile, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow climbed 125 points. We'll call that 1%. The NASDAQ finished up 33 points, nearly 1.2%. The S&P 500 gained 14 points, 1 1/10%. Thanks to Mary Dew, Justin Ho, and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.